call to order the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. First notice, we're going to carry over the possible, I guess, the work session on House Bill 2950. So that will be posted for Tuesday's agenda, work session on House Bill 2950. That bill, amendments and statements on that are not yet ready to go. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2196. Members, it is tax credit day today, and we are hearing four bills related to tax credits, and we're going to start with Representative Bailey to talk to us about 2196. I think unlike the other three, this is a proposal for a new tax credit.
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42. I believe we may be joined shortly by another one of our colleagues, who will be joining us to talk about his perspective on this bill as well. You have before you House Bill 2196, and as written, you may disregard it, because the -2 amendment that has been distributed to the committee replaces the bill in its entirety and changes it. There is a -2 that has been distributed. The -2, however, is also not the final amendment. We had an issue in the drafting that is being corrected, but unfortunately we didn't catch it until later, and it's in the process of being corrected. But the intent of the bill in the -2 should be clear, and I will tell you what the correction that we have requested is.
And we have a -1 as well. But we should disregard
You should disregard the -1.
Okay. Disregard one.
Right. Yes, thank you. The -2 amendment and the subsequent amendments, the intention of the bill is to help establish a market in Oregon for blends of biodiesel that are made from used cooking oil. And in a moment, I'll tell you why that's important and why we're bringing this forward. But Co-Chair Cannon, with all due respect, I'd like to correct one opening comment, in that this is not a tax credit. The proposal around that's proposed in 2196 is an exemption of diesel taxes for blends of biodiesel made from used cooking oil only at B20 or above. It's a very simple bill. So essentially what the bill does is if you are selling a blend of biodiesel at B20, which is a 20% blend of biodiesel, or above, and that biodiesel is made from used cooking oil, then you are exempt from the diesel tax for that amount. Now, I want to clarify a couple of things about that. Why used cooking oil? The reason that we're bringing this forward is that used cooking oil is not only an environmentally friendly way of creating cooking oil, or excuse me, of creating biodiesel, but it is also a way to create biodiesel that mitigates some of the potential adverse effects from making biodiesel. That is, the potential for impact on food prices and the food supply. So we do not run into an issue of food versus fuel. In fact, what used cooking oil does is helps create a market for the waste left from restaurants. And we have businesses in this state that make it as part of their business the collection of this waste cooking oil and grease from restaurants. So imagine you're the local seafood shop and you're deep frying some seafood at the coast and you have a lot of oil left in your fryer afterwards. Rather than paying to dispose that, you can be paid to then send that used cooking oil to one of these companies that turns it into a high-quality biodiesel and then resells it at the pump in this blend. It's a great Oregon product. It's processed mostly here locally in Oregon. It's made from local oils from local restaurants, and it increases that multiplier effect for biodiesel. It also has the lowest carbon footprint of any type of biodiesel. This is why we want to incent the market to produce more of this and to help consumers who want to purchase high blends of this to run in their vehicles to be able to purchase it. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I should tell you why this is important to me personally. I drive a 2005 Jeep Liberty Common Rail Diesel that I purchase, for which I purchase biodiesel at blends of B50 and B99, depending on the season, from Jay's Garage, a locally owned gas station in my district. My Jeep runs fantastic on this biodiesel. It's made from used cooking oil, and my exhaust smells like French fries. And the only challenge with running it is that I'm occasionally tailgated by people who are curious what the smell coming out of my tailpipe is. So if there's any downside to it, it's really just that. But it's a local fuel that runs well year-round. I've had a great experience with it. I know lots of other Oregonians have, and this would be a cheap and easy way to do it. Now, you'll note in the Dash 2 amendment, to get into a few specifics in the bill, the difference between the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 is that the Dash 2 adds a weight limit on it. We want to ensure that this is directed at smaller vehicles. We're not getting into large trucking issues here. We also want to make sure that we're mitigating the revenue impact of the bill. We don't yet have a revenue impact statement, but the word from Legislative Revenue Office is that it's very small in the way that it is now, because it is only biodiesel made from used cooking oil, and it's limited with that weight limit there. So the effect on dollars to the Highway Trust Fund for road construction and maintenance and repair is very limited. The error in Dash 2 that will be corrected in the subsequent edition is in the Dash 2, it proposes a marginal rate in the decrease of the taxation, such that there would be a different tax rate between B20 and B99. That was an error in communication. The subsequent draft will just make a simple exemption of the diesel tax for B20 and up. And that's it. It's a very simple bill. It has bipartisan support. I've been working very closely with my good friend and colleague, Representative Matt Wingard, on this bill, and look forward to the committee's questions.
Did he say? Mm-hmm.
Do you have a question?
I'm sorry. I have a question, Mr. Chair. Representative, I'm just interested. It's kind of a side issue, but I just want to pick up on what you said about using it. Are you saying that right now you could take your Jeep, unmodified, pull into Jay's, fill her up, off you go?
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, that's exactly right. I can pull into Jay's Garage and fill up right now with any blend of biodiesel. It doesn't matter what I already have in my tank. And if later on I'm down the road and I decide that I need to fill up and there isn't a place that sells B20 or B99 nearby, just the regular diesel as blended with the RFS, I can put that right in my tank too. I don't notice a difference.
Wow. Just a quick follow-up. It doesn't matter where I heard this, because I don't know where I heard this, but I heard from somebody at the diesel. I've got a 2000 Beetle. That you can't go back and forth, but that might just be shop talk.
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, we may have some other folks who could speak to the technical specifications. I can tell you that in my personal research and with my personal experience, I have never had an issue going back and forth.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jules Bailey, what kind of gas mileage or diesel mileage do you get, biofuel mileage do you get with that?
Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, according to my car's calculator, when I'm on the highway, I get upwards of about 30 miles per gallon. In town, it's significantly less. It's around 17. I generally have an average of around 24 miles a gallon.
Follow-up? How much does it cost?
Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, the price is competitive. It tends to be around $3.69 to $3.89 or so a gallon when I fill up with the B50 or B100. It's about the same, sometimes a little bit more, and sometimes actually a little bit less than diesel on the market.
So final?
Yes, sir.
So I could go there and put it in my car, too?
Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, assuming you have a diesel, yes.
And I don't. thought of that right after it came out. So.
You would,
if I had a diesel, I could put it in.
The other issue.
You put it in.
In case there is a vast listening audience at home that is now rushing to find their keys to jump in their diesel vehicles and run out there, I should just for the record recommend that folks check with their vehicle manufacturer to make sure that it's right for them. And there are newer types of diesel engines where, because of some of the strict standards that have been put on just the very latest diesel engines, where it may have some issues at higher blends. But certainly for my vehicle at 2005, I have never had a problem.
Well, we can talk offline, but I'm thinking of selling my Beetle.
Are there other questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since as a fellow member of the Tax Credit Committee that met this morning, I'm sure you're ready to answer the scintillating list of questions that we reviewed regarding this particular tax credit. So the first question is, this oil is being used for some other purpose now because these restaurants have places that pick this stuff up, take it someplace. Do we know what's happening to it now, and what is it that this would do to that? Are we thinking it's being dumped on the ground, or what are we thinking?
Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, we may have subsequent testimony that can address that. My understanding is that it's generally a waste product that's paid that restaurants pay to dispose of. And in this case, it reverses that so that restaurants actually get paid to put this into the fuel stream.
Follow-up. Do we have numbers? Has someone gone through the state and done an audit of all the restaurants and seen what's happening to the stuff that this would apply to?
Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, that is part of the challenge that LRO has had in devising a revenue impact statement. But again, we will have subsequent testimony that will be able to give you exact numbers on the total capacity within the state. It is not large.
The 30 cents, the source of the 30 cents, why 30 cents, why not 60, why not 10?
Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, purely for simplicity, it is an exemption from the diesel tax.
So,
and that who benefits?
Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, the beneficiaries would hopefully accrue up the value chain and up the supply chain. In addition to Oregonians who are choosing to drive vehicles that are being run on these higher blends of biodiesel, the assumption is that the beneficiaries would be local companies that are manufacturing this product. Up the supply chain from them, it would be the restaurants that are now supplying this oil. Up the supply chain from them, it would be the farmers that are growing the food that makes the oil that now has a secondary market. And that price would trickle up.
Thank you.
So I guess the piece of this that I'm struggling with a bit is the exemption on trucks. There's a concern that if they were included, there would be too great a revenue impact. Is that?
Co-Chair Cannon, I think there are a number of concerns that have led to the imposition of a cap. The concern, I think, is mostly around the impact on large truck fleets that may then race to one pump or another based on this exemption that could place challenges on the distribution system for this particular kind of biodiesel, as well as a potential revenue impact to the state if we were suddenly to exempt essentially all high blends of biodiesel from the tax. Essentially, what this bill does is create a very, very modest incentive in the market for passenger vehicles, so we can see how the market responds to the incenting of this kind of biodiesel that from a number of public policy goals, whether it's a concern about climate or a concern about food price or a concern about keeping dollars local, appears to have advantages over other kinds of biodiesel. There's not a lot of it being sold in the state at this high blend. It's a very modest proposal that will allow the state to have a sense of how the market responds to these kinds of signals.
Okay. Great. Well, we don't have the representatives from trucking industry signed up to testify. I'd be interested in learning more about the concern related to expanding this further, and so you and I can follow up. Mr. Russell and I can follow up to get a better sense of that.
Great.
Super. Any other questions? Don't see any. With that, we have only one other guest, and we'll continue to hope that Representative Wingard makes it down to testify as well, but we do have Tyson Kiever signed up. So let's hear from Tyson.
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, thanks for having me here today to speak to you. For the record, my name is Tyson Kiever. I am the owner of a 2005 Volkswagen Jetta TDI unmodified that uses high blends of biodiesel, as well as a partner in a local biodiesel company, Sequential Pacific Biodiesel. I'm here today before you just to mention support for this bill and appreciation for the consideration of it. I believe that lower carbon footprint transportation fuels are an important segment of our local energy transportation fuel supply as we go forward. I think this bill helps to incentivize recycled cooking oil feedstock biodiesel to get into the market where there's been a prejudice that we've experienced for recycled cooking oil feedstock biodiesel from the local petroleum industry. A couple points that I wanted to make on this is, one, there's significant ripple effects from this industry. Co-Chair Gilliam, the question you asked earlier, I believe, or maybe it was, excuse me, Representative Pence, regarding the where the product goes to today, if it's not going to biodiesel, the two largest cooking oil collection companies in the state are transporting almost all of their product exclusively to Tacoma, Washington, and exporting it overseas for cattle feed. Our company and a couple of smaller collectors are transporting it to the production facility in Salem and making it into biodiesel. So we have plumbing companies, we have trucking companies, we have biodiesel production facilities in Oregon, as well as retail fuel stations that are all keeping those dollars revolving in the local economy from this particular industry. Second, the state of Hawaii has already approved this a couple years ago, and every gallon of B20 and above is sold exempt from state road fuel tax. Again, that's every gallon to every vehicle that uses B20 or above in the state of Hawaii today. Oregon's not the first to consider this or to pass it. And the other thing that I wanted to point out, just for consideration, again, we really appreciate this bill. We have a lot of Volkswagen Jetta drivers that have small GVW cars, but 10,000 GVW is an interesting number that was chosen. We have lots of larger fleets that would really appreciate the consideration of high blends having the same advantage as, larger trucks having the same advantages as the smaller cars using this product. But 10,000 is a difficult number to delineate because passenger vehicles still get up above 10,000 GVW. I would suggest that 26,000 is a more natural cutoff. That's the line. 26,000 GVW is a natural cutoff. That's where CDL drivers generally come into play. For instance, a 2007 Ford F-350 will weigh almost 15,000 GVW. So I just think that considering the pumps out there, how will they delineate between 10,000 GVW and above? And I'd like consideration just to have no GVW restriction. That's all I have. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Any questions? I'll ask. I mean, I think one of the interests of this committee and this legislature as we consider tax exemptions, tax credits, will be the economic development effects. And I think Representative Bailey spoke to some of the possibilities. Can you put even a finer point on what this might mean for your company or others who are involved in this work in terms of job creation, wealth creation, economic development?
Love to. Co-Chair Cannon. My company, again, Sequential Pacific Biodiesel, we grew out of the garage in Eugene in 1998. We've just crested 70 employees here in the Pacific Northwest, largely spawned from this biodiesel industry as our specialty, from cooking oil collection at restaurants to our production facility here in South Salem. That's a 24/7 production facility, to probably 36 high-blend retail pumps in the region. That's B20 or above with consumers using this product. So we're on target. Last year we did just over $20 million in annual revenue, and we are an Oregon-based company. This industry here is growing largely from farmers that are growing camelina and canola in rotation with grass seed, to restaurants now that are getting paid more for their recycled cooking oil, to trucks that are experiencing cleaner tailpipe emissions and lower carbon footprints and better lubricated engines with higher cetane. So these ripple effects go from, again, from farmers to restaurants to truckers to fuel retailers to production manufacturing facilities. There's significant ripple effects in our local economy from this industry. Again, our company alone, 70-plus jobs.
Okay. Great. Representative Bitts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The information is extremely interesting, some of it in light of the challenges we faced with the cold weather and the blending of the so-called, is it yellow grease? Is that what they call this? Some folks over in Eastern Oregon refer to it as that. This particular blend, and part of the challenge, they just put a blending plant in Ontario because, of course, the fuel coming out of Idaho isn't blended. And so the net result is that most people in Eastern Oregon get to pay more now for the blended fuel because they have just one place to get it. That aside, I guess I have a question about whether or not this particular, if you've reached the point where your blend is such that it doesn't encounter those difficulties with cold weather, and then I have another follow-up question after the answer to that.
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Bentz. Blending is still a necessity when it comes to cold weather with any blend of biodiesel. Our feedstock is primarily recycled cooking oil that ranges from a bunch of different oils originating out of the restaurant. And our product is BQ9000 certified, which is an industry standard for fuel. Our cold flow specifications are, I'd say, on average, within 3 to 5 degrees of any other product available on the market today. So any of those products, including our product in cold weather, will need to be blended with petroleum diesel. Most of the time in the valley here year-round, I can run B99 or 100% biodiesel in my vehicle. A B20 blend, I believe, has been shown to get well below zero in many, many case studies.
Follow-up, thank you. One of the questions we have to ask, given the nature of our tax credit analysis, is why it's necessary. If you have 70 employees now, it sounds like you're doing okay. And so the question would be, what is it, how many other government inputs are there currently to your program? How many other subsidies, how many other devices currently make it work, if any? And would this one be an add-on to, I guess, why? The question is, why do you need it? And, I mean, if the oil is going to wherever and not being poured out on the ground, it's not necessarily a problem. I guess I need to know. There's a whole bunch of questions caught up in that, but why don't you start with the one about why do you need it if you're already doing well enough to have 70 folks working for you?
Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Bentz, appreciate the question. We experienced benefit from a few different programs. For instance, the Betsy program helped us get our production facility and our retail station, Eugene, off the ground. The biomass collector tax credit, which is up for consideration this year, has helped many restaurants start to get paid for cooking oil collection here in the state, and I believe has driven down the price of grease trap service from restaurants. Another credit that's out today is, I believe, $200 per year per vehicle that uses a blend of B99 biodiesel. This particular incentive, though, calls out a focus on recycled cooking oil to continue to help divert product from going overseas and staying here and being used in our local economy, as well as it encourages the use of high blends of biodiesel from B20 and above.
Okay. Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, may I respond briefly to that question from the dais? Thank you. I might also add to Mr. Kiever's response that part of my intention in bringing forward the bill and working this bill, and the reason why I approached Mr. Kiever and others to get help in drafting the concept was twofold. One, my personal experience in not being able to find many locations that offer the product, and understanding from others who are in similar situations that it can be challenging to find that product available for them, made from used cooking oil, and secondarily, a desire to create a little bit of a lean towards a product that I feel has a better societal outcome in terms of mitigating any potential impacts on food prices or on any of the other challenges that we can sometimes see with some of the other ways of producing biofuels, and that by giving the market a bit of a nudge, that we might be able to increase that capacity and affect a bit of a shift.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Kiever. And we will discuss this amongst ourselves before deciding how to proceed. Thank you. With that, if there's no one else to testify on 2196, I'll close that public hearing and open a public hearing on 2521 and ask Kurt Melcher to come on forward and describe this tax credit. Well, I believe I'm correct, committee, in thinking that the remaining three are sunsetting tax credits. They have subsequent referrals to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. I think our committee administrator has passed around has distributed a set of questions that the Joint Committee on Tax Credits has asked policy committees like this one to consider as we decide whether or not to move forward these bills to the their committee. Mr. Melcher.
Thank you, Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to come here and speak to you today. So I did, and we are providing some brief written testimony, and we did also attach the eight questions to our testimony with our answers drafted for your benefit as well. House Bill 2521 would, as you mentioned, extend the tax credit that's currently available to individuals that install fish screening, fish bypass, or fish passage. That would be fishways. This credit is scheduled to be repealed on January 2nd, 2014, and the department is currently prohibited from issuing certificates for this tax credit after January 1st, 2012. As we've talked about before in this committee on other bills, fish screening devices, fish bypass devices, and fishways are very important in protecting our fish resources from the harm that's associated with their being diverted out of a waterway or their passage being impeded within a waterway. And installation of these devices represents really an instantaneous benefit to fish populations in given water bodies. This tax credit is an important incentive that our staff utilizes with the agricultural and other community to assist in getting additional diversion screen, and there is a maximum credit of $5,000 per device. This credit also, we have an extensive cost share program that the department administers where we work with water diverters, agricultural interests, and others to get fish screens and passage devices installed. And it's through a cost share program where we have funds, both federal funds as well as state funds that come through our surcharge on our fishing license that helps pay for the installation of these devices. However, many times as those funds expire or are over-allocated, if you will, that this tax credit becomes one of the only benefits that's available to landowners. And these are voluntary projects. No one is forced to put these screens in. They do so voluntarily. With that, I would conclude my testimony. Happy to answer any questions or provide more details if you like, Chair.
Great. Any questions from members? Representative Krieger.
Kurt, how many screens do you know? We talked about how many had been put in the past, and how far are we behind in places where there's need?
Chair Cannon, Representative Krieger, appreciate that question, and I did look into that after our last hearing. So statewide, we estimate, and this is an estimate, but there's between 50 and 60,000 surface water diversions in the state. We have estimated that about 3,600 of those are what we would consider high priority diversions. They're in areas with anadromous salmon and steelhead or in areas with robust resident fish populations. We currently have, through our cost share program as well as existing voluntary programs that have been implemented through this tax credit, we currently have about 2,000 of those high priority diversions screened.
Do you have a list that you've prioritized in any way that the ones that are most likely to have an effect on migrating anadromous fish?
Chair Cannon, Representative Krieger, what we have is essentially, it's based on really on location, on water body. So, for instance, diversions in the Deschutes may be a high priority, but not, it's not down to the detail of individual diversions. And in many cases, many of these diversions are on private property, so our ability to inventory them is somewhat limited. We have to work through water resources with their diversion database.
Okay, thank you.
Could this incentive works in conjunction with the cost share, assuming that there are funds available for the cost share. What are we talking about in terms of, I've seen some of these fish screens, I know they run the gamut in terms of size, complexity, and expense, but can you give some sense of what we may mean, what this $5,000 may mean for a project? I know we have a few other folks here to testify who may be able also to speak to that. But.
Sure. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, many times this tax credit gets used for relatively small projects and in pump screens, for instance, where they may not have qualified for a cost share program. Additionally, when individuals do qualify for a cost share program, their share, if you will, is 40%. They can use in-kind contributions to come up to their 40%, and many times they utilize their own ranch or farm staff, their own equipment, provide materials, but any out-of-pocket expenses can also be this tax credit can be utilized to cover those out-of-pocket expenses. So it can truly be a standalone or used in conjunction with our cost share program.
Okay. Great. Well, let's hear Representative Benz.
Thank you, Kirk. Did you recall from my days of service on the Fish Passage Task Force many years ago, I thought this was one of those devices that was created as part of that process, and that there were going to be rules put in place in that statutory framework that in some ways were linked to this very credit. But I don't recall clearly if that was the case. I don't see in this list of justifications for the credit any reference back to that previous negotiation, which, if I recall correctly, took about a year. But it seems to me that credit played a big part in how that legislation played out. Has the department gone back and looked to see what the foundation for that credit was, to see if indeed it was linked to other statutory activities many years ago?
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, Representative Benz, I personally have not gone back and looked at that. Be happy to do that, though, and I certainly have some fish screening and fish passage staff that have great institutional knowledge with regard to these programs, including this incentive program. We do have to issue the certificate to allow individuals to qualify for this tax credit. So I'd be happy to look into that and get more information for you.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Okay.
Kurt, I'm just looking at your answer to number 7 on here. You write, many projects are not impacted by the $5,000 tax credit cap. Is that because the cost to the credit taker of the screen is less than $5,000? Is that what you're getting at there?
Chair Cannon, that would be one possibility. So, for instance, if an individual is installing a pump screen on a relatively small diversion, cost far less than $5,000. Obviously, they would not invoke the $5,000 cap. Additionally, there's some screens that are installed that aren't eligible for this incentive. So anything that's associated with a FERC licensed facility does not qualify for this credit as well.
Okay, but just to clarify, there are certain projects where the full cost is covered by the tax credit. Full cost to the person who's installing the screen.
Chair Cannon, I believe the cap is 50% of their costs up to $5,000.
Apologies,
so,
yes.
No matter what.
Yeah.
So they always have some skin in the game, I guess.
Thank you. Great.
Thanks.
Thanks. Let's hear from Richard Kosasin, Katie Fast, and Jim Welsh.
Ladies first. Richard Kosasin, Water for Life, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Chairman. Let me start out perhaps by addressing a question posed by Representative Pence. The history of this truly goes back to the late 80s and the evolution and development of the fish screening program in 1991. And in that time, everybody took a look at the funding of screens and primarily very small diversions, but diversions where fish were present in the water body. We worked with then Representative Dave McTeague and Dave McTeague's staff and put together basically a cooperatively funded program. Part of the funds were expected to come from the landowner. Part of the funds were expected to come from the state in terms of the tax credit, and part of the funds were expected to come from the recreational fishing community by means of a surcharge on licenses. So it truly goes back to 1991, and it was a three-pronged approach in terms of funding the screening program. I would get back to the question that was raised earlier in terms of the list of questions, and it was identified as question number 5, the use of the tax credit is an effective and efficient way to achieve this policy goal. And I would argue very strongly and very adamantly that yes, it is. And the history would demonstrate in 91, 92, 93, the department, I think of Fish and Wildlife, did a wonderful job in terms of setting forth a priority listing of small diversions in the state that should be screened because of fish. And I think at that time, the initial list came out with about 3,000 diversions. And since that time, we continue. It's not probably, in some minds, the greatest degree of progress, but it has been a very comprehensive, strategic degree of progress year in and year out to assure that important diversions are screened. So for that reason, we would very much support the continuation of this program as part of the entire overall funding mechanism.
Thanks, Richard.
Good afternoon, Chair Cannon and Chair Gilliam. For the record, Katie Fast with Oregon Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau is in support of House Bill 2521. This legislation and the tax credit that it extends out has been used by farmers and ranchers throughout the state to promote a public benefit for all Oregonians in Oregon and a policy objective of the legislature for fish protection. And it does so at a pretty minuscule minor cost to the state. If you look through Fish and Wildlife's testimony, about average for the biennium is about $80,000 a year in terms of the tax credit. These projects are run the gamut on cost and size, and many times do not hit that $5,000 cap, and other times the landowner is contributing over 50% of the cost of the project, and we support moving it on through the process. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Katie, I don't know how you gauge the need, the growing need for this exactly. Kirk Melcher testified that the absence of this going forward might encourage, I'm not going to say just farmers and ranchers, but folks to stop voluntarily doing this. Has the need or the use of this tax credit gone steadily up? If you've already covered this, I was out of the room briefly.
Chair Gilliam, I don't think that has been covered. I think as we look at challenges that just fish populations in Oregon are getting faced with in terms of endangered species lists. I think the need just in terms of the species continues to be there and be challenged, especially since ODFNW still has priority diversions that haven't been screened. And I think you'd have to ask the department in terms of what they've seen in terms of usage and if that's going down or going up. Mm-hmm. I would add, as we reach into tough economic times, I know my members are financially strapped right now, and so having extra finances to be able to do voluntary projects is challenging for them right now. So programs like this are important. And it's a tax credit, so it means somebody has a tax liability if they're utilizing it, which the past couple years that's been hard to help you guys with your budget issues.
One last follow-up.
Yeah.
Maybe I should be asking Kurt this as well, but to your point about these are tough times for particularly for our farmers and ranchers, do you think there's an enforcement issue if we don't go forward where it could actually cost you more? You might not voluntarily do it, but if you put it off, you could actually cost yourself some more money if you were compelled to.
Well, Representative or Chair Gilliam, I think that's why we're supportive of programs like this that encourage people to move voluntarily so we can have species protections in place so we don't move into that regulatory program that many times when it's done regulatory, there's additional regulatory hoops you have to go to that make projects more expensive. Mm-hmm. So I think as an industry basis, it's in our best interest to advocate for these voluntary type programs.
Thank you. Some folks, I don't suppose, are familiar with fish screen, but they're not necessarily a happy thing to install because then you have to maintain the thing, clean the thing, make sure it works, and thus any incentive we can use to get the thing in place is good because no one's going to put one in necessarily voluntarily because of the additional work that goes with the device once you've installed it. Is that a correct statement?
Chair Cannon, Gilliam, and Representative Bentz, that's a very good point that I think we both missed is there's a maintenance cost to the farmers and ranchers that we represent in terms of cleaning the screen every year. This will not cover repair costs to them that you might have just in the nature of high water events. So, I would say many times putting just a new device in it is not something that is fun for them to do. So having an incentive there to go a little beyond and beyond and above is important.
Thank you.
Rose?
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, Jim Welsh, Oregon Cattlemen Association, and just want to share with you that we have the same issues as Oregon Farm Bureau and Water for Life here, and that we incur those costs. And if we're going to continue to require fish screening, that this is a public benefit, as it has been, identified in the years past, and we really need to continue the credit for that. And we would appreciate that, and certainly what Katie was just talking about is the annual need for maintenance is costly too, and we found that there is a requirement for screening in some places where we weren't. There isn't really a fish population that needs the protection too, and that has been a real irritation of a few of our people. So, the requirement, if you're going to be required, we certainly want to continue the credits.
Yeah, I'm I guess a little bit confused. I've heard a couple of you allude to the requirement for fish screen. I know that one exists, but is this credit available? I thought that the department's testimony suggested that this credit was available only in cases where folks voluntarily decided to screen.
I'll try that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Chair Cannon, over the duration of and the history of the program, it's been both. But again, I would encourage a review of the evolution of the program dating back to 91, when it was a very large debate in terms of whether this was going to be a longstanding automatic mandatory requirement for all landowners. And that frightened a lot of people in the natural resource community, because some of the screens you were looking at costs of $15,000, $20,000, and $25,000 for installation. And that's the evolution, or that truly gave rise to 1991 legislation, basically setting in priority which small diversions would be screened. And then really through a 7-member fish screening task force, which is under the Department of Fish and Wildlife, to look at that priority listing and encourage and solicit people to voluntarily participate in the program. One of the upward bounds is how many screens could actually be put in a year. And they have, I think, as I previously alluded to, made, I think it's been slow and it's been arduous, but they have made continual progress through predominantly a voluntary program since the early 90s.
Great. Okay, I may ask for more follow-up later from the department, and I'm part of my issue trying to wrestle with how we might align these dollars with the highest priority diversions, and maybe it might be more than $5,000 if it's a diversion with really a significant fish impact, and there doesn't appear to be a mechanism in the current system that aligns the state spending, because that's how I think of it. I mean, whether you call it income tax credit or an expenditure, it has the same effect on the state's budget. How we align that spending with the highest priority diversion so that we can have the greatest public benefit. That's one of the issues that I'm trying to consider.
Chair Cannon, if I just respond to that, this is one of the tools that water users have in the state, and it's my understanding this can be matched with other tools that might help align with priority watersheds. So OEB programs, if money is available, there is the fish screen cost share program as well, but those dollars are limited. So, we're supportive of keeping one of the tools in place, because not all projects might fit into those other funding sources, whereas the larger diversion, high-priority projects may align with those other projects or other funding sources.
Great. Kurt has edged forward. Did you want to have a final word on this?
Only if you'd like me to respond.
Sure. I don't want to spend more than another minute or two on this, because we've got two more bills to hear, but yeah.
Thanks. Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Kurt Melcher, Department of Fish and Wildlife Deputy Director. I did want to just clarify, I think a little bit of the confusion may be in the fact that, yes, there are fish screening requirements for new diversions, and there's fish screening requirements that are triggered under certain construction events. We do not go in and require screens at existing diversions that are not subject to any of those triggering events. So we really do it. It's on a voluntary basis. It's when willing landowners or diverters are interested in screening that when we're talking about the voluntary aspect of this program.
And to clarify, this credit is only available under that latter condition, because there are points at which you require screens. But you're saying that the water right owner, landowner, is not eligible for this credit under when they've been required to screen?
Chair Cannon, I believe they're eligible for this credit regardless of whether it's required or voluntary.
Okay.
And then I did want to also clarify that for when we talk about priority diversions, because we don't go in and mandate that people screen at our priorities, we don't go, they're grandfathered in. That's why we essentially wait for them to come to us. And so many times we may be screening
diversions that are lower on the priority list than some of our highest priorities, but we're not, it's a voluntary program, so it's not as easy as just looking and seeing, are we directing this at the highest priorities? Well, the highest priorities are, we're waiting for them to come to us.
I understand.
Okay.
Thank you. Seeing nothing further on this bill, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2521 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2522. And I'm terrible about allowing our committee administrator to describe the bill. Just crossed my mind. Yeah. You should do that, right?
I'm really good at it.
I think you are. You are. How about we get a description of the bill before we bring up the first panel?
Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. This bill would extend until January 1st, 2008, the tax credit for alternative energy device systems, which commonly include energy-efficient appliances, heating and air conditioning systems, solar systems, fuel cell electric systems, wind electric systems, and wood or pellet stoves. For each resident who installs a tax, one of these tax credit eligible systems in their homes, the maximum credit is $6,000 over a period of 4 years.
Great, thank you. So we'll begin with Director Repine to fill us in here.
Co-Chair Cannon, committee members, for the record, I am Bob Repine, Acting Director of the Department of Energy. I want to pick up on what the staff administrator was talking about and kind of go in a little more detail, if I might, Mr. Chair. There's the way the agency sees, there's two elements to this bill. One is, operated through the agency of Department of Energy. One is more of a credit that's taken directly through the revenue, Department of Revenue as a direct credit. But I'll try to articulate the difference for you. So let's talk about the latter of the ones I talked about. The extension deals with the program of consumers who purchase biomass pellets or biodiesel used for home heating or fuel blends for use in alternative fuel vehicles through tax year January 1, 2018. For these programs, they are based on a value of either, in the case of pellets, it's a $10 per bone dry tonnage, not to exceed $200 per year for that taxpayer. For blended fuels, for the use in alternative fuel vehicles, it's 50 cents per gallon, not to exceed $200 per tax year per vehicle. And the credit for biodiesel used in home heating is 5 cents per gallon, is not to exceed $200 per tax year as well. The department, as I mentioned initially, has minimum involvement with this part of the program. This is a credit program that is run through the Revenue Department. In fact, the citizens would declare this amount on their taxes, and that would be just a direct acknowledgement on their tax form when they mail it in. So we have no involvement directly with this program. Now, these programs have some cross values to us because we, in our RETSI programs, we offer credits for purchasing of pellet stoves, and we also offer credits for purchasing of alternative vehicles. But this program is somewhat of a standalone program. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, probably the best people who can talk about the importance of this program would be the Department of Revenue. Only information we have is the information that we get through the tax credit, the document that's prepared for the assembly. So wanted to just let you know that that's our limited knowledge about this program. So if I might, Mr. Chair, I'll go to the second half of the bill, and that really deals with the extension of the RETSI, or the Residential Energy Tax Credit Program, with the Department of Energy to be continue it through 2018. Mr. Chair, I think what I'd like to do, because I suspect you have a lot of people signed up for this bill and the next bill, I, like the prior witness from Department of Fish and Wildlife, would submit to the committee and you my written comments regarding the nine base questions that are being asked, but we'll entertain questions if that comes up through the discussion. So in the interest of time, I thought I'd just kind of shorten this a little bit for you.
I appreciate that, yeah.
So we will get that to you by end of day or first of tomorrow. So what I'm going to try to do is give you just some history of the department, of this program with the department, and I know staff, prior to the meeting started, has sent, you should have a two-sided document here for you. And so I think the history of what has transpired today and how it started kind of lays the framework of this program in many ways. So just again, from a history perspective, the RETC program was created in 1977, so it obviously has gone back many years in the state's history. First credit was issued in 1978. And interestingly enough, the program was actually originally designed for solar and geothermal heating systems and wind electric generation. So those were the main principles back in 1977. So it was all renewable focused at that time. In 1998, the program was expanded to include premium efficiency appliances, duct testing and sealing, heat pumps and air conditioning systems, furnaces, boilers, hybrid alternative fuel vehicles. So a greater expansion of the program took place much later, 20 years later in 1998. So currently the program, as you see on your spreadsheet, is program and opportunities to use this program are broken out in the following categories. Again, somewhat repetitive of what I just said, but I'll say it so people understand the breadth of the qualifying programs that are available for this credit program. Premium efficiency appliances, again, that includes dishwashers, clothes washers, refrigerators, water heaters, duct testing and sealing, heat pumps and air conditioning systems, furnaces, boilers, and air handlers, plug-in hybrid alternative fuel vehicles, fuel cells, wood and pellet stoves, and renewables in the larger category. Appliances is the most popular credit, as you can see on that spreadsheet. Again, this two-sided show shows you 2009 to 2010. 37,712 appliance credits were issued in 2009. 57,536 were issued in 2010. For these programs, the subsidy that comes from the BETC program includes washers can have a range of $60 to $80. Clothes washers can include a range from $150 to $180. Refrigerators from $50 to $90. And the appliances are issued these based on their performance standard. And in the last year, as just to show you how this does change, in the last year for the eligible dishwashers, in 2010, 76% of those that were eligible in the marketplace would have qualified for our program. Today, based on the recalibration of the efficiencies of these appliances, only 35% of those appliances would qualify for our program. Same with refrigerators. In 2010, 85% of those refrigerators that were available for purchase would have qualified for the RETC program. Today, by the efficiency standards that we use to calculate this, there's only 8% of those. And so that has, we keep trying to change that to make sure that we're moving to the most effective and efficient appliances using this credit. Again, in 2000, over 50,000 credits were issued in calendar year 2009, and 79,900, almost 80,000 credits were issued in 2010. The credit value in 2009 was under $14 million. And in 2010, a little over $20 million was used in the credit program. The value of the program on total purchased, so in 2009 was $135 million worth of products were purchased using that $14 million worth of credits. And in 2010, $166 million worth of products were purchased using that $20 million worth of credit value. So what I'd like to do, again, go through the sheet that I've handed out to you. What we've tried to do is give you the kind of the broadest picture we can to show you where the investments are being made in the last 2-year period of time. And to show you where, as an example, I'm going to use the renewables on the first part. On 2010, you'll notice that there was just under 800 of these renewable applications. This is primarily made up of solar applications. I think you'll see the growth based on 2010. If you flip over the backside of the piece of paper, in 2010, we've had almost 1,300 of these solar applications. Much of this is due, I think, to a couple things that have driven this. The Solarized City program that has been accomplished in the state of Oregon in a variety of communities, Pendleton, Portland, and the Salem area, to name a couple, and some federal tax credits that were available as well. So I think that has caused a great increase in those activities. And I know there's people from the solar industry who are signed up to testify. Again, you'll see on the second item, the appliances are the largest group. And while they don't necessarily represent, though they do represent the largest amount of tax credits as well, that is the most popular program that we have within the RETC portfolio. And then they break down accordingly, as you see down the sheet, from different requests for programs, everything from the duct sizing to the alternative vehicles. So again, this was to give you a fairly good idea of the amount of program money that goes out, where it goes out, and it also gives you some efficiencies that are part of the reports that we have to do on an annualized basis. So it talks about the CO2 reductions by each of the programs, and it also gives you a conversion factor based on the energy that has been saved and what it correlates to if you were to calculate that based on a single household. So again, the program is designed for efficiencies, energy efficiencies, and energy creation opportunities through renewables. And this is the measurements that we use in order to demonstrate or show the results of those investments over time. This is a program that is not capped, like the different from the BETC program, which is capped for the manufacturing and the renewable. This is not a capped program. And you can see that it has grown over the last few years. And again, I think a lot of that is attributed to some of the other programs that were out there with the federal programs, particularly in the last year. So, Mr. Chairman, that's just a brief overview. Again, I will furnish our comments relative to the 9 base questions that are being asked of all people, all testifiers, so you have an idea of what the more ramifications of the program might be for us.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Rethine? Great. I hope you'll stick around to hear from others. I'm just going to go in order on the list here and bring folks up in panels. We have, it looks like, 10 signed up to testify. Let's begin with Mark Pengilly, Adam Walsh, Matthew Lind, and if you'll keep your comments relatively brief since we still have an additional bill to do. Come on up. I won't put a timer on, but I'm thinking, you know, sort of in the 2-3-minute range for each of the 10 folks who are signed up.
Thank you, Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee. My name is Mark Pengilly. I'm here on behalf of Oregonians for Renewable Energy Policy, and I also represent the interests of residential solar contractors and owners of residential solar systems. I want to speak specifically to the impact of House Bill 2522 on the residential solar industry. Oregonians for Renewable Energy Policy has not been traditionally a champion of tax credits. In fact, in the 2009 session, we lobbied to have tax credits excluded from the solar pilot project because of their impact on the state budget and because we felt that the feed-in tariff system was a better way to finance production of renewable energy. However, I think that this RETC tax credit for residential solar is absolutely vital to the continued life of the industry. I had some materials submitted digitally, and committee staff suggests that one of the graphs may not have come through. This is a graph which shows the declining installed cost per watt of solar in Oregon over the last few years as compared to nationwide. The other graph that I have submitted is a graph of the Energy Trust-funded solar installations. And you can see that for many years, with only slight increases, in 2009 and 2010, the number of residential solar installations skyrocketed. At the same time, you'll see that there's been a marked decrease in the cost of these systems. So when you consider these various tax credits and you look at these graphs, you have to conclude that this tax credit has been very effective in increasing residential solar installations. We use local electricians, local solar contractors. We can use locally manufactured components. These systems can be financed locally, and these dollars recirculate through our local economies. There's momentum to this industry. As I've mentioned in my written comments, we have invested in the manufacturing base here. We need to maintain our market for the products, the manufacture of which we've supported here. Stability of incentives has always been a problem for solar, and some of the solar contractors speak of living on the solar coaster. Sometimes they have a subsidy, then it's gone. I would use the analogy of weaning calves. If you cut off the subsidy, if you cut off the milk too soon, the calves die. I hope to be before you in a future session advocating for a more robust permanent feed-in tariff program. But all we have so far is a very small pilot. It's not enough to sustain the industry. So while the green grass of a feed-in tariff may be out there in the future, I think we need to continue the subsidy, the tax credits for residential solar until we can move to the green grass of the feed-in tariff. If we sunset this tax credit now, the industry will simply experience a catastrophe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Adam Walsh. I'm with the City of Eugene. I wanted to share with you the city's support for the extension of this tax credit. It's been the main financial driver in the installation of the residential systems that we have in Eugene, especially with regard to solar, thermal, and photovoltaic systems, and we'd ask for your support. It's in line with stated council goals related to energy and sustainability. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Lind?
Representative Cannon, Representative Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Matthew Lind, and I work for a solar contractor called Advanced Energy Systems. We're based in Eugene, and we employ 24 people. First, I just want to say thanks for being included. This is an opportunity for me, and it's nice to be part of the process. And also forgive me because this is my first time, so I got a little nervous, and I don't know if my remarks will fall in line with what you typically hear. I just did my best, but
you're doing great.
It's okay. Well, part of what I wrote down was a brief little background of who I am, and I'm going to condense that to essentially say I'm a native of Salem. I'm a product of Oregon. I went to the University of Oregon Law School. I believe in this state. I love this state, and I'm really excited to be a part of this emerging industry, the solar industry, renewable energy. And I think what I want to say as my chief message to compliment my colleagues is that Oregon, because of the programs that you guys have implemented, and it sounds like since 1977, so this is not new, but Oregon is now very well positioned. And we have a lead nationally. We're looked at as kind of the leader in this field. Certainly, we've attracted amazing manufacturing to come to the state. And so, what I'm here to say is that we need the RETC, and we need the Betsy. That's another topic, but we need the RETC because we have a position that we have to maintain. And I think when we look out 5 years, 10 years, what that translates to is job growth, economic growth. And as a 34-year-old young entrepreneur, when I look at my future in this state, I believe it's in this industry, but it requires this RETC program. I think one other point I'd like to mention is that essentially the RETC is the mechanism that allows the small guy, the homeowner, to get involved in clean energy. And this is important because not only do we need these folks to get involved, but it helps them understand how it works. They promote it among their peers. Essentially, they're investing in a fixed cost system, and over the life of that system, which is 40 plus years, they achieve a hedge against the future rising cost of utility energy, and we expect that to increase dramatically over the near term. So this does have a payback. It helps get us a strong foothold as this industry emerges into a global industry. That's all I have for now. Thank you.
Thanks. Really appreciate you making the trip to the Capitol today and being a part of the process.
Thank you for having us.
Very nice job.
Thank you.
Any comments, questions? All right. Thanks to all three of you. We'll move on to Glenn Montgomery, Keith Knowles, Nick Armstrong. So, gentlemen, just a couple, three minutes each. And sorry to have to rush you along. I know it's an important topic, but in any order.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, representatives in the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. So I represent the trade group that is comprised of members who are anything from a residential installer, a sole proprietor working on the rooftop, installing solar thermal or PV, to the solar worlds of our universe. So I have a very broad constituency. You just heard from two of my members out of the last panel. You're going to hear from a couple of more on my right here as well. Briefly, the Residential Energy Tax Credit is a successful program. It's been around for over 30 years, but it's only been in the last few years that it has really been recognized as a tool for homeowners to leverage public dollars and participate in a process that drives us away from fossil fuels and into renewables. And we've seen that with the programs such as Solarize and others that have helped catalyze the activity in the industry. The RETC programs help us leverage what the state sees as a goal and a worthy investment with private sector to achieve some very successful objectives. In the last year, we saw a fourfold increase in the residential solar market on the PV side, the electricity generation. Again, Mark had already suggested what some of those factors were, and Bob Repine from ODO also mentioned Solarize Portland, Solarize Salem, Pendleton, etc. But without the RETC, those programs wouldn't be moving forward. It really does help tip the scale and convince folks to change their behavior. And for that reason alone, I think we need to continue to provide that tax credit. We are still not at a point where the costs are such that we can compete with traditional sources of energy. And so it's a difficult decision, and especially as we get beyond the early adopters of this program, those people who are very much in favor of renewables and want to do the right thing, we're moving now into the mainstream where people are having to take a closer look at the pure economics. What's the payback for them? How are they going to be able to afford this? So as we continue to penetrate that market, the RETC will continue to be an effective tool for us to be successful. I'm going to reserve the rest of my comments for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. You're up.
Chairman Cannon, Chairman Gilliam, committee members, thank you for having us here today. My name is Keith Knowles with Live Light Energy. I brought to you today two things. One is our success story as a company related to Betsy, but we've also related greatly from RETC. And the other is a U.S. Green Building Council report on job creation and job growth for green jobs. And it's at a national perspective, but as somebody pointed out earlier, Oregon has taken a leadership position in green construction and building. And I happen to come from a construction heritage, having owned a construction company with my father. I have to say that solar and green energy energy and energy efficiency is really what has supported us through this recession. And in fact, we as a company, Liveline Energy, we have grown sixfold in revenue in 2010. We grew fourfold with the market in installations. We employ 15 people, and we are solarizing Pendleton, benefiting the east side of the state. We just started working with Beaverton to solarize Beaverton. And we are creating many more jobs and many more opportunities for the citizens of this state to save energy and be more local. To give you a very brief illustration, in 2006, Oregonians spent nearly $10 billion on energy. And it is calculated that about 85% of that money actually left the state. So with solar, you can spend a dollar on solar, and it will employ somebody and help with local manufacturing, since we have become a leader in the country for solar manufacturing. And then that dollar will multiply in terms of energy savings to system owners, and it will hedge their bet against energy inflation. It will allow them to save money that can be spent, again, locally in the economy. So there's a multiplying effect that a dollar spent on renewable energy creates that the RETSI program must continue to support. I'll reserve the rest of my time for questions.
Thanks very much. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Co-Chairman Cannon, Co-Chairman Gillian, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nick Armstrong, Oregonian for the last 32 years, and I am here representing Solar City. I will keep it very short, but we've launched Oregon operations here two and a half years ago, with our first project starting in Intel, and our residential side launched 1 year ago. We have installed over 300 systems in Oregon, employing 30 people in our office and warehouse. We employ journeyman electricians, apprentice electricians, general laborers, and project managers. The RETSI enables us to provide options to our customers that include reducing the cost and payback period for their purchase and allowing them the option of little or no money down. Without the RETSI, it's impossible to offer this system to a customer that has a reasonable payback period given Oregon's exceptional low electricity rates. With the RETSI, we have grown our operations, opening a new office with a warehouse and hiring a staff count of 27 new hires in the last year. The growth is allowing us to provide more solar generated power to the customers at a more efficient rate. If the RETSI were to stop, we'd be looking at shutting down our office, laying all our staff off. Our progress as a state leading the reduction of our carbon footprint, and for the matter, also as a country, would diminish. The RETSI, in combination with energy trust incentives, has created job growth for our company and for many other companies. The RETSI is critical to the success in the renewable energy sector in Oregon. I'd like to encourage all of you to keep supporting the renewable energy sector and the jobs it creates in Oregon. And thank you, guys.
Thank you. You two did a terrific job keeping your comments brief. You came in right at 2 minutes. And I'll see if there are questions. I have one for Mr. Knowles. It's interesting, in your handout, which is really about the Betsy,
yeah,
you have an anecdote that sort of illustrates maybe some of the inefficiencies or challenges with the RETSI. In fact, it seems to point out that the RETSI may not work because the Betsy is more generous.
Originally, I was under the impression this was a Betsy hearing, so forgive me, I came prepared for that more so than the RETSI. But with regard to home builder installed solar, which is a subsegment of the greater Betsy, it's a benefit to builders because it helps helps them offer a better advantage to somebody buying a new home with solar on it. And that just happens to be, because of our home builder heritage, that happens to be a good market niche for us as a company. I'm not trying to point out the weaknesses of one or the other. I'm just trying to point out the fact that home builder installed solar under Betsy is a very valid program also, in addition to the RETSI.
Right. So do you know if there's any rationale for having what appears to be a more generous per watt Betsy?
Yeah, one, I guess
Betsy versus RETSI.
Yeah, in terms of the Betsy, I think it's just because it's its own program separate from RETSI, and RETSI rules were just recently changed as of the beginning of the year. So because they're separate programs, they were not subject to the same rule change that RETSI went through.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to get a follow-up from Mr. Repine on that. Thanks very much to the three of you. Peggy Woolsey, Jody Weiser, and Steve Robinson are the next three, and then we'll have a final panel of two before we open up the next hearing.
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee. For the record, I am Peggy Woolsey. I volunteer with Tax Fairness Oregon. And on the sign-in sheet, it asked if I was for, against, or neutral. And I have a lot of questions about the RETC, and I guess it puts me in the neutral position. We're spending almost $30 million a biennium on the RETC program now. Since there is a sunset, this is the best time that we will have to improve the program. Without answers to the questions that I have, it's hard to know what the improvements might be. The first question, how much energy is saved in each part of the RETC as it is now? For each program, what's the relationship between the subsidy dollar provided and the kilowatt hour saved? Why do we subsidize the particular mix that we do? Other states and ETO have not made the same decisions that were made in the RETC. What parts of weatherization are most cost effective? What renewables are most cost effective? Are the RETC subsidies pushing what is cost effective? We've seen the cost of the solar installations come down over the years, and we think that that's a good example of something that's been pushed. ETO and the Department of Energy are the subject matter experts. It would be very helpful for each of them to provide answers to this question. If the legislature were to cut this program by 50%, where and how would they recommend the cuts be made? When we have the answers to these questions, then I'd appreciate an opportunity to speak again.
Thank you for your testimony, and please do feel free to follow up with the committee. We are expecting, and Mr. Repine is committed to answering the questions that the Tax Fairness, the Tax
Joint Committee
on Tax Credits has suggested, including the one you mentioned. Also, make sure that you get a copy of this handout that Mr. Repine supplied to the committee, because it does address your leading question. Yeah, go ahead.
Jody Weiser, also with Tax Fairness Oregon. So Oregon has just moved from fourth to third place in the nation for its energy efficiency policies. And that's probably a position we don't hold for hardly anything else that high a position. And we're spending $30 million per biennium on the RETC as part of the support of that position that we're in. But we believe that probably RETC needs new guidelines and cost caps, and the department needs more authority to operate within general guidelines that you provide. Right now, the law says things like subsidized dishwashers or subsidized wood pellet stoves or pay 35% of the cost. Instead, it might be more profitable if you would say spend no more than this amount on renewables and this amount on efficiency and do the best you can to pay attention to our efficiency standards, our renewable portfolio standards, and job creation. Figure out how to do it best. So the kind of policy guidelines you might look at would be, what portion of your dollars do you want spent on renewables, and what portion do you want spent on efficiency? The balance has changed recently because of the rapid growth in renewables. We saw in the last 3.5 years, we spent $7.4 million of RETC dollars on solar, but 2.7 of that was in the first 6 months of 2010. So there's a huge uptick there that other people have testified to. Should also ask yourselves, how much of the cost of a facility do you think of a project should we pay? Should we be paying 100%, 80%, 70%, 60%? What should we as taxpayers and ratepayers pay, and what percentage of ownership should the people who are actually going to own the whatever it is that they're getting, what should they pay? Right now, the only limit is 100%. Now, I don't know anything in the RETC program that does get 100% subsidy, but we were very close to that with the solar installations until a change that was made in July. You could put a $13,000 solar array on your house and pay $650. The rest of it was everybody else was paying instead of you. And there's an article in the packet I gave you that describes that problem very well, and it also describes the change, but it brings up why you need to give the department more authority to make changes. They looked around for how can we change this, and they used the only mechanism they could think of. But as the costs drop further, we'll be asking less and less participation of the people who are putting solar on their house again. Right now it's about 25%. So if you could write something that would say to them, we want people who are putting solar on their house to have subsidies that total no more than, and name your percentage, then they could figure out how to do that and they could adjust their rates. ETO has that kind of ability, but the Department of Energy does not. We think that you should consider a policy that would say you can't do the most expensive things, put solar on your house or put a windmill in your yard, if you haven't done the least expensive things, the insulating your under your house or your crawl space is way more cost effective. And the subsidy that the public is providing is a small, much smaller dollar for the same number of kilowatt hours. So if you want to say I'm green and put up your solar panels, don't ask for public support if you haven't done the other things you should do to insulate your house and put in energy efficient furnaces and appliances. You should ask yourself, do you want Oregon's policies to be more generous or more lenient or similar to those policies of our neighbors? Yesterday we worked hard to create a spreadsheet that you have today. It's the best job we could do in a day of giving you current subsidies in our state and our neighboring states. The part in gray, you would combine those two, the RETC and the ETO, to get what Oregon subsidies are. And then we pulled what we could find on the internet and at the Desire website for what was available in Washington with one of their utilities that looks similar to what ETO does, and in California with one of their utilities that does things similar to what we do. Those two states also are in the top five states for being highly efficient. So our policies would be comparable, and Washington's utility prices are about the same as ours. California's are quite a bit higher.
If you could wrap it up.
Right. So another thing you might ask is if you want to change it. So if we're subsidizing solar, do we want that solar to be made in Oregon? Or do we want it to be made in China? You could say, well, we'll have a different rate for where you're getting your equipment from. As we were doing, as I was asking, and there's many more pages for you to read and good examples in what I've handed you, I sent this to a former college professor who often does the proofreading for us and editing. And he said, oh my goodness, in proofing your testimony today, I realize that I'm probably eligible to have a tax credit for the furnace I just replaced because my furnace went out. It was never mentioned to me that there would be any tax credits available. And so he quickly did some searching. He found out he's eligible for the Betsy, and he's eligible for a federal tax credit. It was never mentioned to him. Clearly, that subsidy is not pushing his behavior. I bought a dishwasher last week. I shopped at two stores. Nobody mentioned the benefits. And while Mr. Rapine is probably right that across the nation, the number of machines that we would subsidize is fairly low, if you walk into Best Buy today, you'll find that dishwashers, the item we've committed the most to, we've spent $13 million in the last 3.5 years supporting the purchase of clothes washers. He found was that 84% of the clothes washers available today at Best Buy in Salem were eligible for RETSI. And he was told that while they have a handful of models that are not eligible, now that the rules for RETSI have changed as of the first of this year, they will be phased out as soon as their current stock is gone. In other words, in Oregon, people buy energy-efficient appliances. Most of the ones that they carry in the stores are energy-efficient. And so if you look at the other examples in my testimony, you'll see that over and over people are experiencing that is not even a push. Everybody expects you at the store to care about energy efficiency. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Jenny.
Messrs. Co-Chair and committee members, my name is Steve Robinson, Principal Policy Analyst at Decision Metrics. I work quite a bit with the Human Services Coalition on budget and revenue issues. I've done quite a bit of analysis of the tax expenditure report, especially with regard to how the benefits are distributed among the various groups of taxpayers according to their levels of adjusted gross income. The tax expenditure report is a terrific resource, and I'm very appreciative of the effort that goes into it every biennium by the staff at the Department of Revenue, as well as the various agencies that contribute their analyses to the discussions of each one. Quite often, however, the administering agencies don't ask the hard questions or engage in rigorous analysis of whether a given tax credit is an effective or efficient way to accomplish a valuable social goal. Regarding the RETSI, the existing legislation lacks a statement of purpose, which Representative Bailey and Bence's Joint Tax Credit Committee has asked you to supply if you want to recommend extension of the credit. The department is guessing that your purpose was to promote the use of the kinds of devices that qualify for the credit. Nobody is more positive or enthusiastic about this goal than I am, but the department goes on to claim that the RETSI is successful in achieving this purpose in view of the growth of energy-efficient appliances and vehicles in recent years. But it makes no effort to evaluate the windfall effect with this credit. What do I mean by that? When you receive a windfall, it means you get something for nothing, like winning a door prize. You didn't make any decisions or change your behavior in order to earn the prize. You just lucked into it. The windfall effect is a well-known drawback of many tax credit programs. In evaluating whether any particular tax credit, like the RETSI, is worthy of extending in the face of a multi-billion dollar budget shortfall, the legislature will have to be careful to consider how much of the dollars being invested in that credit is, in effect, a windfall for those taking advantage of it. One strong signal that the windfall effect is present is how the credit is distributed among the income groups. For the RETSI, nearly 60% of the total benefit is claimed by the top 20% of income earners, three times their pro rata share. The bottom 20% of income earners, on the other hand, claim less than 2% of the credit. In other words, the RETSI is more than 10 times as beneficial to the higher income folks as it is to the poor. The department claims in the tax expenditure report that most of Oregon's 3.7 million residents can benefit from the program. But to me, that statement rings hollow in view of the fact that the benefit is so strongly skewed in favor of the wealthy. If we want to encourage the use of alternative energy devices, wouldn't it be better to establish a marketing channel, perhaps a catalog, where residents can shop for such devices and receive a discount subsidized by the state that's a sliding scale based on income? A program like that would live in the general fund budget and be subject to the standard controls and accountability applicable to such programs, but unfortunately not applicable to most tax credits. Please look carefully at each element of the RETSI to make sure you avoid these windfall effects wherever possible. Thanks for your attention.
Thanks for your testimony. Are there any questions? There are not. Thank you for being here today. And we'll go to our final panel of two, Larry Scruggs and, sorry, I can't quite read your name, it may be Peter Grubers. Or it may not.
Peter, anyway.
Buddy's coming up, so.
Thank you very much, Chairman Cannon, Co-Chair Gillum, representatives of the members of the committee. My name is Larry Scruggs. I currently live in Portland, and I'm here to speak regarding our subsidy of biodiesel, biofuels, and biomass used by drivers and homeowners. As you saw in the testimony on earlier bills, it appears as though there are other subsidies for the same thing as what you're talking about in this bill. We're currently spending about $1.3 million per biennium on the biofuels and biomass used by homeowners and drivers. I'm curious, first, why we don't do this as a guaranteed loan or as a grant, instead as to why are we doing it as a tax credit instead of a guaranteed loan where we can recover the money. And secondly, my understanding is that this is not intended to be a permanent program, but instead was to be a temporary program, and we've been doing it for 5 years, and I'm curious how much longer we're going to do it. Because as you're all aware, and as you're facing your difficulties balancing the budget, we have lots of places to spend money. And I'm more concerned about education and cops and infrastructure right now, and I think that's a better place to spend the money. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Yes, sir.
Peter Greenberg, we manufacture energy-efficient lighting. We put in a couple hundred kilowatts of solar panels, and I've made about 10% of the solar water heaters in the state about 25 years ago. The people that spoke before me from Tax Fairness brought up a lot of good points. This bill just moves the program on, but doesn't really look at making it better. And I've always felt that there's lots of room for improvement, even though the program is very good. And I've worked with the Department of Energy for years, and they really can't do that much. First, the legislature has to do something, and then they have hearings and rules, and you know, a year goes by before something gets changed. It seems like there should be some goals and strategies. If you want to extend it 5 years, there's grants to look at. What makes the most sense in spending money? Renewables cost a lot more than efficiency. Seems like it could be a much broader bill or a broader way of looking at things to look at the totality of what you're actually doing and give the Department of Energy some ground rules and let them run with what they think is a good program. We're going to be manufacturing solar water heaters. 10 years ago, somebody convinced a legislator to give five times more money per kilowatt hour for photovoltaics and solar water heaters. So the solar water heater industry is nothing, a couple hundred thousand dollars a year in tax credits, and the PV industry is doing very well because there's a lot of money. So it's I don't think it's really enough to just pass the program. You really need to fine-tune the program and see how you can get as cost-effective as possible. Thanks.
Thank you. I really appreciate both your testimony. I think that's a appropriate note to end on. If there are any questions, Representative Boone?
Yeah, I just have a comment to make. I hear from constituents all the time asking me, they said, I saw something in the paper, there's ads from Energy Trust about the credits, and I've had some people say I've had a very inefficient system for years, and now with this tax credit, it gives me the oomph to go out and buy the new equipment that will save me money in the long run, it will be cleaner, et cetera. And then I know this is a Retsy thing and not a Betsy thing, but I can't let you go without mentioning in the other part of the renewable energy world, the rest of the world other than the U.S., and in North America, we have lots of projects in this area, in this sector, that would probably not be operating right now as pilots or whatever they are without the Betsy. And they realize that in some sense, some cases, that has been utilized maybe not the way they intended it to, but in any case, they have always said, we need it to start with, we need it to go for a little while, but you know, you don't need it to continue it forever. But they do need it to get going in some cases. I think both of these programs are very valuable for us.
Yeah, well, quick response, please.
Just to comment briefly, I think we're all in agreement that something needs to be done with this. The concern is the efficiency of the programs, the duplication of tax credits to where you're giving money multiple times for the same thing. We can be more efficient, we can operate better than that, and that's what I think we're all after while we're here.
A slight comment. With us making solar water heaters, I could easily buy everything in China and not make anything here. We manufacture lighting fixtures and save our customers about 100 million kilowatt hours a year. and we decide to we want to build something in the United States. We're building the tank and all the metal parts, which is the bulk of the cost of the system. But it's about $500 more than if we just bought all the parts in China. So for the solar industry in general, there would be no industry without tax incentives. If the federal tax credits go away, if the energy trust goes away, if the Betsy goes away, basically the industry would die overnight, which is what happened with the solar water heater industry in 86. The federal government got out of the game and 95% of the industry stopped. So,
great. Thank you. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2522 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3170. Thank you for your patience. Those of you who are here for this bill, you'll see the time. We are up against a hard 5 o'clock stop. So, Director Peterson, if you want to kick this off, and then we have four other folks signed up to testify. Or, yes.
Yes. Excuse me, Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dick Peterson, Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and I'll keep my remarks very short. My testimony is being passed around, and DEQ processes tax credit requests for both new truck engines and the repower and retrofit engines, and you'll also get the answers to the question for each one of those tax credits that are coming around as well. And I'm just going to talk very briefly about each one of those. First on the truck engine tax credit, clean burning EPA certified engines installed in new trucks purchased and registered in Oregon are eligible for a tax credit. The credit only applies to engine models years between 2003 through 2013. The credits range from $400 per engine to $925, depending on the number of trucks owned prior to purchasing a new engine. It's a sliding scale based on the size of the business, so the smaller the business is, the larger the tax credits that would be given. DEQ has authority to approve up to $500,000 in truck engine tax credits each calendar year, but no more than $80,000 to any one taxpayer. In the 2007-2009 biennium, DEQ approved just over 1,000 eligible engines for about $484,000 in tax credits, which is about half of the total amount authorized for the 2 years. We expect to issue a similar amount in the current biennium. While we don't have any definite emission reduction numbers for the new engine tax credit, we estimate that about 19 tons of particulate emissions may be reduced each year as a result of this retrofits or the work from this tax credit. Now on to number two, diesel repower and retrofit tax credit. The 2007 legislature approved the repower and retrofit tax credit. Both of these tax credits require 50% usage in Oregon for at least 3 subsequent years. Repower means replacing an older, higher polluting engine with a less polluting new used or remanufactured engine. The credit is limited to non-road engines and requires scrapping the old engine, so it cannot be used for anything but scrap metal. Retrofit means to upgrade currently operating diesel engines with new advanced exhaust controls to reduce the most harmful pollutants with the greatest impact to public health and the environment. The DEQ may certify a maximum of $3 million in clean diesel repower and retrofit tax credits in any one calendar year. In the 2007-09 biennium, DEQ approved repower and retrofit credits for a total of about $360,000. In this current biennium, we're expecting to issue about $1.3 million in tax credits. Most of these are going to tugboats, towboat engines that are being worked on and repowered. We estimate that to date, repower and retrofit retrofits that are connected to these tax credits have reduced emissions by about 6.9 tons per year. In summary, diesel engine replacement, retrofit, and repower provides both economic and environmental benefit. It's estimated that for each dollars spent on reducing diesel emission. There's $5 in environmental and public health benefit. The tax credits are one of several strategies to reduce diesel emissions, and we also rely on some federal grants to finance projects. So with that, Mr. Co-Chair, that's the end of my testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. We have four other folks signed up to testify. I suspect that if we needed to carry this over to Tuesday to finish our conversation on this bill, we would have time on Tuesday to do so. And I don't want to rush through this. I realize we are trying to cram a lot in. So my sense is we'll just see how this goes over the next 10 minutes, see if we get through folks without it feeling terribly rushed. And if we don't, then we'll carry over. So let me first ask whether anybody else who signed up on the sheet could not be back on Tuesday to testify. So I have Ralph Groener, Bob Russell, Ben Wills, and Larry Scruggs. Anybody? Great. So that option appears to be available to us. We'll just go in order. Mr. Groener, Mr. Russell, we'll start with the two of you.
Russell's checking this here. Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, I'll rush. My name's Ralph Groener from AskMe. I represent the coalition with Bob Russell and a group of us that formed in 07 to come together, and I'm going to say it a little bit differently than Dick did to you. This reminds me, this program, of Project Independence. Some of you are aware of that program, which I helped write. I chaired that committee, and I feel very honored to say that I'm with Bob Russell and others that want to reduce the significant health care costs due to diesel as pollution in the air. We've contributed, the goal was 14, pardon me, I had my notes from Kevin Downing, 1,400 tons is our goal to reduce cancer in this state by the year 2017 significantly. So what this is a bit different than you're used to. This is a measure to reduce the cost because in 95% of Oregonians now live within these polluted kinds where diesel pollution impacts them with asthma, cancer, and heart disease, many times higher than exhaust from automobiles. So I'll just say this. We focused on school buses with open, I forgot the words on it, Bob would know. And let me tell you, the school districts where we've went after school buses with your money, taxpayer money first, because we found out kids were sitting in buses with unbelievable toxic amount of emissions inside the bus compared to being outside. And the result is that we help grants and with your money free up grants in Vail, Weston, Athena, Klamath Falls, Bend, Medford, Ashland, Eagle Point, Douglas County, Lane, Salem, Kaiser, Albany, Independence, Metro Area, Beaverton, Reynolds, and Centennial, and it goes on. We have cleaned up those buses, particularly in the rural areas that are the older buses. So kids, according to the studies out of the State Department of DEQ, they don't call it that in Washington, have reduced significantly the health problems with children on the buses, and they statistically have numbers on that, as well as reduced the cost for the bus drivers. So the elderly, I say what this is about is similar to Project Independent, and it's our ARP program. I pay dues to AARP. I'm one of your older legislators. These are regarding our older trucks. We're trying to clean them up. They last too darn long. 25, what, Bob, 30 years, the older trucks. They're really efficient. One thing they're not efficient at is polluting. They're efficient at polluting. The problem is it increased the cost to the health care of this state so significantly that we've got to continue this program if we're going to fight cancer, health care, and asthma. It's a much bigger issue than just this committee has heard the background on. I'll close at that and hope you can see it in your heart to continue this wonderful preventative health care program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Groener.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. I'm going to be very, very brief. I think Director Peterson did an excellent job in sort of outlining what's in this bill, although I think there's one point of emphasis. There's actually two programs here in this particular bill. There's the truck engine tax credit, which is the first part of the bill, and it's the trucking industry and my members that are the sole beneficiaries of that program. The second one is the one that Ralph has been talking about, is the clean diesel program. That not only has tax credits, but it has loans and it has grants, and it does... Actually, since its inception in 2007, they've done a retrofit on one truck. The rest of it has been on other diesel engines, tugboats, school buses, other kinds of things. So they're very different, and when we're thinking about them, we need to think about them as separate programs. So with that, I will attempt to answer any questions that you might have on these programs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We may not have time to get in all the complexities today. I'm curious about the mechanism of the tax credit, how effective it has been as a tax credit, and the trade-offs between tax credits, appropriations, and how you might use one or the other.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, you know, I think when we did this in 2003, and just speaking of the diesel engine tax credit, the first part, the idea was to provide an incentive for people to move up to the new trucks as the Environmental Protection Agency imposed more and more stringent requirements for our engines. We had new engines in 2004, which is when the initial tax credit applied to those engines. Then in 2007, we had another version. And then the latest version is in 2010. The 2010 engine compared to the 2003 engine, it produces 95% less NOx, 95% less particulates. Kevin Downing from DEQ says that the 2007 engine, the exhaust is cleaner than the air in Los Angeles. The 2010 engine is cleaner than the air in Portland. We're going to now route the exhaust of our trucks into the cab in order to improve our driver's health. But the idea with the tax credit was to encourage us, as we got these new generations of engine, to step up to the new engines. As we've gone through that process, the cost of the engines has also gone up exponentially. And when you look at a tax credit that's taken over 4 years, that's $400, and you talk about a truck that's somewhere between $70,000 and $110,000, I'm not sure that this is the right policy, quite frankly. It's the question between tax credits and appropriations, which was your other question. At our most recent board meeting, we had a lengthy conversation about this particular tax credit and about that very subject. My industry has suffered mightily in this recession. I think in general we've been down about 20%. Some segments of our industry have been down as much as 60%, those that are sort of associated with logging and log truckers and those folks. I mean, it has been a very difficult period of time. And it's caused them to think about things in a different way. And they are not as enamored with the public policy of providing tax credits as they may have once been. And some of the folks that have benefited the most from the new engine tax credit were lukewarm, is probably even a little strong in terms of this particular tax credit. Now, we also talked about other things that government might do to help the trucking industry that we think would be a much better approach, if that's what you're referring to. We have asked, and it's in Representative Bence's committee, the bill at the moment, and with a sub-referral down to Ways and Means, for an appropriation of $500,000 one time that would set up a revolving loan fund that would pay the tuition for people to become truck drivers. We've been working with the community colleges for the last 5 years, and we've developed a statewide program with all the community colleges participating. Of course, the last couple of years, we didn't need a lot of truck drivers. But the good news is that things are starting to pick up. And our new president, Deborah Dunn, is sitting in the back of the room, and she has just toured the entire state. And she kept calling me and saying, they're saying, we need more truck drivers now. So if you want to help the trucking industry and help the economy, a one-time appropriation would be a much better thing for us than this tax credit that we currently enjoy. And we would certainly support replacing this tax credit with that appropriation if the legislature thought that was an appropriate thing to do.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment. Excuse me.
Please.
Ralph Groener again. Kevin and I talked on the phone while you were holding other hearings, and he said, I asked him some of the questions I thought you would ask, but the cost per ton of diesel pollution, it cost us $62,000 to clean up a ton, but the studies are now in by EPA. We've saved $700,000 in health care costs documented. My interest, and maybe Bob's, really are the same, but we also have separate interests. My interest really lies in public health. You've read articles where you live in Portland about the cost of diesel pollution next to the apartments going up along the freeways, about 1,000 times more dangerous to those kids living there or lower income. Primarily because the diesel pollution's hitting him. I just want to see us retrofit diesel pollution, whether it's school buses. We did it with our garbage trucks in Metro, made another bill last session, and the haulers did that through their own fee. So this is a very serious health issue to Oregon, and I would hope that we continue to try to reduce the diesel regarding health-related incidences.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think Ralph and I are on the same page. The comments that I made have nothing to do with the clean diesel program, which is the second tax credit. My comments are strictly limited to the new truck engine tax credit. I don't think that there's any disagreement around.
No.
Great. I understand. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you.
We will. Well, we have two more folks. It's 5 o'clock. You'll be very brief.
I can do mine in 1 minute.
Great. Come on up, Mr. Scruggs and Mr. Wills.
I've got a committee. I've got a meeting at 5.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, members of the committee. My credential as I address this issue, I was the chief operating officer at RAS Transportation for 3 years. We ran a number of buses throughout the area and have quite a bit of experience with diesel engines. My point is this subsidy is really irrelevant because when we would retrofit an engine, you would always use new parts. Because they're much more efficient, they're much more effective, and 95% of the stuff, I would say 100%, but I can think of a few occasions that we used equipment, but almost always it was new, and you're upgrading as you go along. The $950 subsidy for the engine is such a small part of the overall cost, and the benefits you receive from putting in a new, improved, more efficient engine, the subsidy has nothing to do with whether or not you make that decision. The real decision is what's the return on your investment, and that's always with new equipment. And so I would agree with the gentleman with the Trucking Association. What you're trying to do with the policy is really laudatory. It's good. But I don't think this is the way to go about doing it.
Thank you for your comments. Yes, sir.
Chair Cannon, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, thank you for hearing my comments on such short notice. My name is Ben Wills with Tax Fairness Oregon. I, as well, just wanted to reiterate Bob Russell's comments and insight that this may not be the best policy for achieving this purpose. In the most recent tax expenditure report, the Department of Environmental Quality's evaluation of this program stated that the majority of new truck owners that this have applied for this credit would have purchased the truck with or without the credit. And if that's correct, this tax credit really doesn't have much bearing on the rate of turnover to these more efficient engines. And, you know, in that light, I think allowing this particular tax credit to sunset would be a prudent move under our current financial circumstances.
And just to be clear, are you speaking to both of the credits?
No, strictly to the truck engine tax credit, not to the repower and retrofit, which Ralph so eloquently spoke for.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Any questions? Seeing none, thanks for your brevity. Thanks for your patience. With that, we will close the public hearing on 3170 and close the committee.